It is a pleasure to introduce our next instructors based in Orange County, California. Jonna Heldman brings more than three decades of experience to the management of investment portfolios. Prior to founding Triad, he was a senior vice president and portfolio manager with Neuberger Berman. He has also managed institutional and individual investment portfolios for Deutsche Bank, Scudder Investments, and Bank of America. John holds a BS degree in finance and an MBA from California State University, Long Beach. He is a CFA charterholder. Dave Hutchinson has more than two decades of experience in investment management. Before joining Triad in 2013, he worked in manager research for Chamberlain Group. Prior to that, David founded Hutchinson Capital. He holds a BA in political science from McAllister College and an MBA from USC's Marshall School of Business. Dave is a CFA charterholder. John and Dave have shared their wisdom and ideas with our members in the past, and we are grateful they have chosen this opportunity to be with us again. On behalf of the MOI Global Membership Community, a very warm welcome.
Great. Well, thank you, Alex, for the introduction. We sure appreciate it. And we appreciate the opportunity to speak with the MOI community. Once again, we've presented in the past and we found it to be very beneficial just on our side as you prepare to discuss one of your ideas, it makes you review it even more closely. So thank you. This is our disclaimer, which I'm sure everybody will read very closely as we do. The next slide here is just a little bit about us. We are a focused investment advisory firm, a registered investment advisor with the SEC, specialize in investing in concentrated portfolios for a group of affluent families and individuals based in Newport Beach, California. My partner founded our firm in 2008. We've developed over time an investment universe of about 175 or so companies that we use to build our client portfolios. Our focus is on investing in competitively advantaged businesses. We look for signs that today's advantages will also continue into the future and hopefully strengthen as well. We really like to partner with owner operators who have more equity in the game than fixed cash compensation. We ask ourselves, do they wake up in the morning and think about how they can grow the stock price versus their paycheck, so to speak? We think that's a very good opportunity for an investor. And then we are value investors. We develop our own internal estimates of value, and we seek to invest when we see a meaningful discount from the current market price. Now a little bit about the company we'll talk about today, Mohawk Industries. Mohawk is the world's largest flooring manufacturer. They are the leader in every flooring category. They lead in ceramic, carpet, laminate, wood, luxury vinyl tile, or LVT, which we'll be talking a little bit about today, sheet vinyl, which is a little bit more inexpensive, stone flooring, and then they also are a leader in countertops as well. So they're finding related businesses as well. Their wide offering lets them benefit as consumer tastes shift from one type of flooring to another. One type change we've seen in the last several years has been the shift from more soft flooring to hard flooring like stone and vinyl. They're a global player, vertically integrated. They like to start, they work to be touch all aspects from the beginning of manufacturing fiber to distributing the product. They have grown through M&A, but they are in a lot of ways very decentralized. They want their local businesses, global businesses, to be responsive to local markets. But they are run by, we think, a very good CEO, and there is a centralized strategy with a clear focus on growing shareholder value over time. They have a long-term mentality. They're willing to invest in the business in both down years and up years, and we've seen that very recently as they've been committed to growing in even uncertain periods because they are focused on growing shareholder value. And one reason they are so focused on shareholder value is that their CEO, who we respect very much, Jeff Lorberbaum, is a 14% owner of Mohawk. So that's over $1 billion of stock. And he's been with the company since the early 90s. And we think he's done a good job of allocating capital and driving the strategic direction of Mohawk, which was a far smaller business when he joined it. The next slide is, this is from Mohawk's own presentation in July. A few things to note here, the EBITDA margin of the business as reported on this slide would be about 17%. It did reach almost 20%, but in our conversations with the company, they think high teens and this level is more likely. We think will be a little higher than 17%, but they are not expecting it to reach the prior high. They've invested over $8 billion in CapEx and M&A in the last 5 years through 2018. They've done 44 deals since 1992. They're globally present with sales in 170 countries, manufacturing in 19 countries, and 25,000 customers worldwide. This slide gives you a sense of the product and sales mix. The chart on the left indicates that about two-thirds of their business is related to flooring. Both they have a segment, Flooring NA, which is North America, and then Flooring ROW, Flooring Rest of the World. Nearly 40% of their revenues come from the outside the U.S., and that's been increasing over the past few years. And also not noted on this slide, but worth noting, is about historically about 80% of their revenues have been coming from residential end users and 20% from commercial end users. This slide gives you an idea. M&A is a big part of Mohawk, and it's one reason they're as big as they are, and not all companies are good acquirers, but we think Mohawk is a pretty good acquirer, and this is some of the things they look for, and they seem to, when we look at some of the deals they've done, they seem to look for all of these factors, and they're all important to them. Usually when we see an acquisition made, it's for them to do one of the first two things. It's to enter or expand in a new geography, or become more dominant, or to add a product line that has become more and more prevalent among end user tastes, and they're trying to expand their capacity there. They've done that repeatedly over time. We do think that the management is very important. Some companies would say it's less important because they'll just put their own people in there. With Mohawk's decentralized approach, they would really want to have a team in there. They're buying the company and the team, and they want to be able to run it. And in some cases, I think they've found that the team isn't up to, if it's not up to snuff, they'll have to come in and replace it. But they want that management team to be in place. They want the unit to run on its own as much as possible in sync with the rest of the business, of course. The next slide is from a couple years ago's annual report, 2017's, but I liked it because it kind of gives you a sense of all of the things they're doing worldwide to improve their, not only their, you know, introductions into new markets or new products, but expansions to existing plants, like the under Mexico, Mexican ceramic, they added capacity there. Acquisitions to get into new product lines and to grow products, and then some of the pending things here, like Godfrey Hirst, have obviously been completed already. But as we said, that's about $8 billion. In this world, it's about $8 billion of deals, and about half of that going just to capital expenditures dedicated to improving the businesses. And really, if we look at it from an owner perspective, trying to improve, deepen in the moat that they have in their business and to grow it, you know, and not remain static. The business is organized in three segments, which I'll go over briefly now. The first segment I'll talk about is global ceramic. As you can see, floor tile, wall tile, mosaic, outdoor flooring, interior cladding, and countertops in a variety of materials, which they're increasingly producing internally, which is really their goal. We've seen them sometimes introduce or enter a market and not be the manufacturer of the product, but over time, that is definitely their goal with their vertical integration focus. Some of their advantages are the brands that they own, Daltile being one, Marazzi, recently acquired Elion, and American Oleon. They are the worldwide leader in ceramic, number one in North America, Brazil, Europe, and Russia. So that's pretty good coverage there. They're likely the lowest cost producer given their scale and their ability to have locally distributed manufacturing, given that tile is and ceramics relatively heavy. Global capacity in this industry is 146 billion square feet, and they have about 2.4 billion square feet capacity internally. So that's roughly a 2% market share of ceramic. Their distribution is very strong, particularly in North America. All their distribution in North America is very strong. And then their product innovation in all of their segments is important. And tile, some of the innovation we've seen has been a non-slip tile, complex wall tiles, so they're getting into more aesthetic product than just functional products, and their ability to make large porcelain panels as well. Some of the investments they've made in this business have been in the U.S. to add a quartz countertop plant so they can do more internally manufactured countertop product. And that complements the porcelain that they still import from Italy, but import from themselves. So it's all within the Mohawk family. And then they've also been modernizing their European ceramic manufacturing capability to expand on the premium side, which is definitely their emphasis and their focus on profitability. This chart here gives you a little bit of a sense of the global exposure of the business and where some of the brands are based and strongest. And they do share best practices, you know, despite being centralized. This is definitely a centrally run company, and they share their best practices worldwide. And often, you know, the developments they come up with in one market can be shared in some regards in another. This is just a brief breakout of the tile market. One thing of note, we've talked with the company, they have attempted to participate in the Chinese market, but they have said, they told us they've tried and really it's not a profitable market for them. So they probably will not be addressing that part of the market. Now, if we turn to slide 12, flooring North America is the next segment. So carpet, rugs, laminate, LVT, luxury vinyl tile, sheet vinyl, wood, pretty much what you would expect. The reason it's an interesting business is that they are the leader. They are leaders in all channels. They have leading brands that are very well known, and most of us have in our home probably some Mohawk product. I think we do. They are a low-cost integrated manufacturer, and their innovation in flooring includes environmentally friendly products, Smart Strand. They have a product called Air.O that's a unified flooring that includes the cushioned backing along with the carpet, and it is made with recycled PET fiber, PET fiber. So those are the areas where they've been able to stay ahead, both with innovation by their name recognition, the lowest cost, and innovation. So those are a lot of ways to maintain a moat over time. Over time, we've seen a shift from soft carpet flooring to hard flooring, especially LVT. LVT in the United States has started to really take off and is growing 20% a year now. So they've added globally 5 plants to add LVT capacity. And that's been one reason, you know, that it's been a shortfall in the most recent year, and it's something they're working on aggressively to address. And right now, LVT is about 13% of their North American business. This chart on slide 13 indicates the breakout of the U.S. flooring market, with carpet still, even though it's less, as I mentioned, less prevalent, is still 43% of the market. Ceramic in second place, wood third place. But LVT will be increasingly a bigger part of this pie chart. On the next slide is the last segment, which is flooring rest of world, ROW, laminate, LVT, sheet vinyl, and whatnot. They have different dominant brands. IVC is their LVT brand that is based in Belgium, and I think we're starting to see that brand in the United States as well. Pergo is a very well-known brand they acquired a few years ago. And in the rest of the world, what they're looking at is they're the leader in the mid to high-end categories, especially LVT, and they're looking to expand their sheet vinyl capacity in Russia, for example. So they're looking for capacity adds. They're looking to backward integrate. So they've doubled the capacity of adhesive production. It gives you an idea of how down to the minutia they are in Belgium. And on the M&A side, they made a major acquisition last year, adding Godfrey Hirst to give them leadership in Australia and New Zealand. This slide gives you a little bit of a sense of the different product types, the brands, and then the channels that they are distributed through, with sheet vinyl and LVT on the right side, and that that's becoming a much, much bigger part of their whole global business. And now I'll turn to John, who'll discuss our investment thesis.
Thanks, Dave. So we're on page 16 right now. So Dave's done a good job of giving you a good sense of what the business is all about. So I'm just going to quickly go through our investment thesis. So Mohawk incorporates everything that we like to find in a business. It's a very strong, long-term oriented business that's relatively easy to understand, run by great people. We have a lot of faith in the management team. And then lastly, value. We find that the value for us right now is better than has been the case over the last few years when the company was really firing on all cylinders. So just quickly, we like the business. It's a global leader, as Dave mentioned. It's a global business. It's fragmented, but yet it's consolidating. The global tile market is about 146 billion square feet right now. Mohawk, as the leader, still has a single-digit market share. Not all of that is going to be easily available. China, as Dave mentioned, is a difficult market for them, and it's a big market. So, the realistic opportunity for them is certainly not the entire market, but we still think there's lots of room for them to run. The other thing we like is the vertical integration. We think that's a key component of the business. It's not a commodity business, but it's a business where you do have to manage your costs very carefully. And being vertically integrated in terms of manufacturing and distribution does position them to be a low-cost provider, and that does allow them to better control their long-term destiny. The global distribution network gives quick service to customers, and retailers don't carry much in the way of inventory, so it's important that when a customer buys a product that the delivery is done quickly. And then contractors on the tile side, if they run out of tiles and they need more tile to finish the job, again, delivery is very important there. The strong balance sheet allows the company to keep spending even during the occasional downturns. And let's not forget that this is a cyclical business. So there are going to be upturns and downturns, but having a strong balance sheet does allow them to keep spending on more facilities around the world, new products, making acquisitions. It's critical to have that balance sheet. And acquisitions, particularly during downturns, allow you to acquire at more attractive prices. And a lot of competitors are just not able to do anything during an extensive downturn. It is a cyclical business, as we mentioned. We're not sure if it's at the trough, but it's in a downturn. It's tough to know whether you're right at the bottom, but we're certainly a long way down from the top. And we've got a growing business here with a modest multiple on currently depressed earnings. So we like to buy quality growth cyclicals during downturns, such as we think is the case today. So moving to slide 17, Dave's already talked about the advantages. I won't go through them extensively, but again, low-cost producer, brands cover all the segments across the flooring world. Having all those different brands and segments leverages scale in manufacturing and distribution. Has extensive distribution. That's important to the customers, particularly the smaller retailers. Customer relationships important as well. The customers really lean on Mohawk for a lot of different things, and we'll go into that a little bit later. And then we've mentioned the financial strength. That's a true competitive advantage. And then lastly, sustainability. It really is important in this area. There's a lot of cost savings to be had through recycling and other sustainability inputs, and it also enhances the company's reputation. All right, moving along to slide 18. These are the growth drivers: the capital investment, internal capital investment, M&A, and then the capital allocation skills of the management team. So moving to the next slide, capital investment. You know, it is a capital intensive business, and staying on top of capital investment is important. The company spent about almost $2.5 billion in the 2016-2018 period on internal investment. Actually, if you extend that going back to 2013 through 2019, that number is closer to $5 billion that they've spent. So that's during a period where it was pretty robust in terms of sales and also through the downturn. So they haven't let off the gas in terms of continuing to spend. And again, manufacturing and distribution facilities around the world has been part of what they've spent the money on. Geographic expansion internally and through acquisitions. New product development has also been important to them. And again, you know, people think, well, flooring, you know, it's kind of a commodity. What's the big deal about flooring? Well, like a lot of areas of life, technology is finding its way into the flooring world. So you find technology improvements that result in easier installation, better waterproofing of the surface, improved slip resistance, better looks, and improved durability. And all of these things are important to the end consumer, and it makes the job of the customer, the retailer, easier in terms of making that sale. So we think that new product development is definitely a strong suit of Mohawk. And then they've spent on manufacturing improvements, a process, automation. They're constantly spending money on looking to improve their processes to enhance quality and lower costs and increase profitability. And then logistics, again, they continue to spend money on logistics to help serve the customer. Okay, next slide, 20. Acquisitions have been a big part of the company's growth going back many, many years. They've invested $4.3 billion since 2013 in acquisitions, again, focused on geographic expansion around the world. They're really focused particularly outside of North America, where there's much more opportunity than there is in North America. They're also looking to acquire new product categories to push through their global distribution system. And then what's also important to them is each acquisition, they want to make sure there's a management team there, because the company does operate in a decentralized manner. And, you know, the CEO put it as, you know, we're not looking to buy assets. We can buy assets. What we're really looking for is a management team that's going to stick around and stay with us. And they've even passed on acquisitions where they didn't think that the management team was going to remain with the company. So, you know, management is very critical to them. They are a disciplined acquirer. They do measure the return on investment on acquisitions. They look at a hurdle rate, and the hurdle rate depends on what the risk level seems to be. So we like the fact that they're not just acquiring for the sake of getting bigger. They're acquiring where they think it fits into their global system and where the returns are going to be there for shareholders. A couple of recent examples, Dave mentioned Godfrey Hirst in Australia, New Zealand, closed in 2018, is the largest flooring company, integrated into an existing Mohawk business, so allowing them to gain greater scale. And then Elian in Brazil, again, a leading manufacturer in Brazil, and Mohawk is currently investing capital to improve product and lower costs. Okay, turning to slide 21, capital allocation. So the company generates free cash flow, even though we're at a depressed point in the cycle. They continue to generate free cash flow. We estimate about $750 million a year on average over the next 3 to 5 years. And so that does give them some flexibility in terms of how to spend that. The first priority is to reinvest internally in the business, and then acquisitions, as we mentioned. And the capital allocation has been roughly 50-50 in terms of reinvesting in the business and making acquisitions. And then lastly, with any leftover funds, the company does periodically repurchase shares. They're careful about where they buy those shares. They're not just one of these, you know, automatic pilot type companies that just buy shares back regardless. So in 2019, they bought back at a roughly $119 a share. And then so far this year, they bought back about $77 million at about $130 a share. So, which is roughly where the stock is today. So we pay attention where we think a company is a smart repurchaser because, excuse me, that gives us sort of a marker as to how the company views its own stock, and it allows us to kind of monitor that versus our own purchases. Okay, moving along to slide 22. What are the risks? Well, it is a cyclical business, and it is subject to consumer spending, and a recession would certainly impact home remodeling, which is a big part of their business. It would also likely impact new home purchases, which Mohawk is less dependent on new home purchases, but nevertheless, there is that cyclical element to their business. Another risk is the inability to make acquisitions, which would lower the long-term growth rate. But we're not too concerned about this. The company has a history of making acquisitions, and the market globally is still very fragmented. So we think that the company will continue to be able to make acquisitions. Another risk is, you know, Jeff Lorberbaum, the CEO. He's been there since the early 1990s. He's been significantly responsible for the company's strategies, particularly on the acquisition side. And I think the company would miss him if he were no longer there. However, you know, the playbook has been well established, we think. And while the company would miss him, we don't think that it would be significantly detrimental to the company on a longer term basis. There are emerging markets risks. The company does business in emerging markets and, you know, subject to the risks there. And then lastly, they do have some issues with costs, particularly oil prices because of the use of petroleum in the carpet, particularly, and also oil impacts their transportation costs. So they have, when costs have gone up significantly in a short period of time, it has been a challenge for them to recover those costs over a short period of time. But they have had good success in eventually recovering those costs over a sort of intermediate time frame, over an 18 to 24 month period. So it is a risk, but you know, it's one that we think is a modest risk and not a significant risk. So, but those are some of the risks that we see. Okay, turning to slide 23, this is our look at the company's valuation. So we look at things on a 3 to 5 year basis and try to ask ourselves, you know, what do we think the company will look like over a 3 to 5 year period in terms of sales and earnings and its potential stock valuation, recognizing that this is just a point estimate and, you know, there is a range of likely outcomes. So looking out over the next 3 to 5 years, we're assuming about 5% growth on the top line, and that does include some acquisitions. The organic growth rate is likely to be, you know, low single digits, but we think the company will continue to make acquisitions. In terms of its EBITDA margins, we're expecting the company to be able to raise margins a bit as some of the recent cost pressures start to dissipate a bit, and some of the price increases, which have, you know, just recently been put through, start to have their impact on the bottom line. And then they've also, again, spent a lot of money on both acquisitions and new facilities, either greenfield facilities or expanding facilities. And all of that has happened in a relatively compressed time period. So we also think that as those facilities start to ramp up and the capacity utilization increases, that that is going to help the cost structure and also lead to slightly higher margins. We're using an 11 times EBITDA multiple. We don't think that's expensive for a global leader in a industry where we still think there's plenty of growth opportunities ahead of the company. And historically, during stronger growth periods for the company, the EBITDA multiple historically has gotten up to 11 or 12 times EBITDA. So we don't, we think that that's a reasonable multiple for a global leader. So we come to our equity valuation, net of debt. The company is going to generate free cash flow, as we mentioned. So we incorporate that free cash flow into our valuation. And we think the company is going to have enough free cash flow that it'll be able to buy back some shares over the next 3 to 5 years. So we anticipate a modest reduction in shares outstanding. And as you can see, that gets us to a stock valuation over the next 3 to 5 years that's significantly in excess of where the shares trade today, which is around actually around $130 or $128 today. The stock's been weak in the last week or so, given what's going on in the Middle East and its impact, potential impact on higher oil prices. And we think that's had some short-term negative impact on Mohawk shares. But to us, that that just makes the valuation a little bit more attractive to us. So I will leave it there. That is our that's our overview of the company, and we're happy to take questions.
John and Dave, thank you very, very much. The first thing we have is, you mentioned since Jeffrey Lobelbaum has joined the company in the 90s, there have been over 40 acquisitions, and just since 2013, 19 acquisitions. To what extent would you say he's foremost a capital allocator and secondly a manager?
Well, he's, I would say, we would say, he's probably foremost a capital allocator. Although he's very good in running the business, he's a hands-on manager. Although the company is managed in a decentralized manner, and the reason for that is just simply the global nature of the business. It would be foolish for a manager to try and micromanage Russia and South America, Europe, all different parts of the globe. So he's, he's hands off in that sense because he realizes that it's just not feasible to try and manage. But we do think that he's a great capital allocator. So I guess if we had to, rank those, we'd probably rank him as a capital allocator first, and a manager second. But we don't think there's a big gap between those two.
When purchasing, you mentioned he was very disciplined, and he not only did he demand certain ROI, but he also tried to invest where he saw the management staying in place. How is management in the acquired companies incented to stay on?
Well, that's a good question. It's the usual. Stock compensation contracts with management teams to make sure. But I think the real critical aspect is culture. They want to make sure when they talk to an acquisition candidate that they have a management team that loves the business and is, while compensation is important, it's not necessarily just about compensation. It's about, somebody who really does love the business and wants to stick with the business. And as we mentioned, you know, they have through due diligence talked to management teams and really liked the business, but got the feeling that the management was not really gonna interested in sticking around, was gonna move on and maybe do another startup or go somewhere else. And so they've passed on those acquisitions. So it's, you know, it's a combination of culture and, you know, cold hard cash compensation.
And you could also add that, you know, I think those business owners probably see it as a good home for their business, given that it's run by a long-term owner with a long-term mentality, such as we've seen with Berkshire Hathaway or even Thor, other businesses where that's part of their attraction to a seller.
Yeah. You know, a good example, they made an acquisition, IVC, a few years ago, and the owner, the majority owner of IVC, is now on the board of Mohawk. And, you know, his advice has been extremely helpful to the continuing business, but you can see the loyalty. This person has been buying more Mohawk stock over the last year or so and buying a lot of it because he believes in the business. So I think they're very careful about the people aspect and making sure that they're not, you know, acquiring mercenaries who are going to move on at the, you know, at the, you know, the slightest increase in compensation.
Has expanding the geographical footprint to countries that might have different economic cycles reduced the cyclicality of Mohawk as a business?
I think that is a good point. It certainly, as they become more like the global economy versus the U.S. economy, you're going to have different cycles and different points of the cycle for different markets. So that's a side benefit of the globalization that they're doing. But yeah, like we said, they are committed to, you know, despite the cyclicality, you know, looking ahead and making long-term investments at all times, you know, whenever this opportunity can present itself, especially in M&A at any point. So I think that's a really good point.
What data points are you tracking to either validate or challenge your thesis?
Well, you know, we continue to look at the things that they do. So on the acquisition front, we look at the acquisitions that they've made. Does it make sense from a, you know, strategic standpoint in terms of, you know, growing the top line? Does it gain them new products, new geographies? Does the company continue to spend and not pull back, particularly during down periods? And I think they've really shown us with the down period that they're currently in, which, you know, to be fair, is not that long. It's only been about a year or so, maybe a little bit longer than that, that the downturn has existed. But they have continued to spend, and they do take a long-term orientation. And they tell people, we're not going to manage for the next quarter or two. We're managing for the next 5 years at least. And so we continue to look at that. And are their actions consistent with that long-term orientation? And, you know, one of the things that would upset us is if they decided to cut back on spending during a down period just to, you know, to protect their balance sheet or whatever it may be. We want to make sure that, you know, they're doing what they say they're going to do. And so that's, you know, those are the data points that we look at. Are they continuing to spend capital appropriately on internal investment, increasing profitability? Their margins have held up, we think, relatively well, even though, you know, the sales sales have tailed off a bit. And also, they've been facing a lot of cost increases, but yet they've offset some of that by continuing to invest on projects internally that will help to maintain their cost structure and their margin structure. So, you know, those are the things we're looking at: internal investment, you know, doing what they can to maintain margins, continue to generate free cash flow, and then wisely allocating that free cash flow again, on the repurchase front, we keep a careful eye on at what level are you buying back stock. And they've proven to us that they are, they're ROI focused. So they will buy back stock when they think that it makes sense. They're, you know, the stock got up to $280, a little bit back, and they weren't buying back any stock. But here we are, the stock's $130, and they're buying back stock. So to us, that's another proof point that the company is, doing what they said they would.
Does the company enjoy any benefit as a growing cap-intensive business by having maintenance capex that would be less than its depreciation and amortization?
Any benefit?
Tax benefit.
Well, the maintenance capex, part of their capex is maintenance, but part of it is growth capex. And it's hard to separate out maintenance versus growth because some of their maintenance capex is actually capex that's spent internally and not necessarily for growth, but to improve their manufacturing processes to help to lower their cost structure. So it's kind of difficult for us to parse out the different aspects of capex in terms of maintenance or growth, but they certainly are, some of their capex is oriented toward new manufacturing facilities. Some of it's maintenance, but some of it is sort of a mixture of the two.
Which public or private companies would you consider to be the closest comparables?
Well, the market itself is pretty, on the one hand, it's consolidated, but on the other hand, it's relatively fragmented. So the big competitor here in the United States particularly is Shaw, which was a publicly traded company and was acquired by Berkshire Hathaway a number of years ago. There isn't a lot of data on Shaw through Berkshire Hathaway's corporate reports. But we do read other, public trade data on Shaw, and Shaw is, the biggest competitor here. There's smaller competitors also here in the United States and then globally. But, we think that globally, the company stands apart from most of the competition in that it's larger, it's publicly traded with access to capital that many of the competitors do not have access to. We think the management team is better than just about all the others. So we think it's a unique company that's, we don't think there's a lot of strong competition, and that's one of the attractions we think to the shares.
Would Mohawk's decentralized structure offer it some protection in a situation of worse trading relationships, even between the US and the EU?
That's a good question. I don't know that it might provide some benefit because they might be able to make adjustments in strategy a little bit more at the local country level than a company that was super centralized and centrally controlled.
And also, a lot of their manufacturing is done, in Europe, for instance. It may not, it may be done in, let's say, one country in Europe, and the products are sold in other countries, but they obviously are aware of, the trade situation globally and want to have as much manufacturing done locally as possible. So they're not exposed to producing all of their products here in the US and then subject to export restrictions globally. The other reality is that if you look at the nature of the product, if you're talking about carpet or tile, it's pretty heavy. So the transportation costs of shipping it from the United States to Europe or somewhere else are prohibitive. So that's another reason why you're going to be seeing a lot of in-country manufacturing to support the sales structure.
Well, also presume protects it from other competitors coming into their markets.
Yes. You mean you're talking about the transportation costs?
Yeah.
Yes, we didn't really emphasize that, but that certainly is another aspect of their business that makes it more difficult for, you know, there is a low-cost imported tile, for instance, here in the United States, but it's limited, and it tends to be on the lower end. So certainly the transportation costs are a factor for global competitors to have to deal with in terms of, you know, trying to compete with Mohawk.
And that would also be reinforced in the future, presumably, with the increased automation that would favor, you know, favor local production.
Not sure what you're referring to there.
So as the industry becomes increasingly automated, the labor cost advantage of producing a low-cost location, you know, would be reduced over time.
Yeah, that definitely will be the case as the things become more automated. Labor as a percent of the total cost does shrink. So again, having local manufacturing is likely to be more important, particularly as the manufacturing is automated.
Thank you very much. Those are all my questions. I'd encourage our members, if they have any questions or thoughts, to reach out to John and Dave directly. Thank you very much for contributing to Best Ideas 2020.
Thank you, Alex. We appreciate the opportunity to present to your members.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.